Before listening to today's episode, please know that there are conversations around grief, mourning, and suicide. So please take care while listening.
Welcome to Torah Smash, the podcast for nerdy Jews, where our lives of Jewish learning collide with our love of nerd culture. In each episode, we discuss what we lovingly call a Torah Smash, which we have defined as a beautiful collision of one thing from the world of Judaism with another from nerd culture. I'm Ethan Lane Miller, and joining me today are
Barak Malkin,
RDY.
Before we get into today's topic, I want to remind our listeners to mark your calendars and get ready, because just 10 days after this episode releases, we'll have Torah Smash Live. Join Barak, RDY, and myself on January 13th in Chicago. This is the first time all three of us will be together in person in the same zip code, and to celebrate, you're invited to join us for a live recording of Torah Smash. So join us Saturday, January 13th, 2024 at KAM Isaiah Israel. For more details on this event, go to torahsmash.com/live. This will be your chance to meet us in person and see for yourselves that two of us are real people and one of us is actually a Muppet. But I'm not going to tell you who. So with that, on to our episode. It is so good to be with you both.
Welcome back, Ethan.
Really good to have you back.
And I really know how to explain. So I want to talk directly about my brief hiatus from Torah Smash and where I've been. On November 8th, my girlfriend Kaya died by suicide. She battled treatment-resistant mental illness her entire life and fought as hard as she could, as long as she could. Kaya was one of the most gifted teachers I have ever met. There was a passion and caring in everything she did in her classroom. Everything was seen through the lens of how can I make this a teachable moment for the children in her class. We had just celebrated 1 year together and were very, very much in love. We talked about the important things, like having our cats meet so that we could move in one day, to marriage and what our children might look like. Our relationship transformed both of us deeply in profound ways. Our time together included nerdy activities. One of our favorite things to do was watch the reality TV competition Lego Masters. And so Lego became a cornerstone of our relationship. My Valentine's Day gift to her were Lego roses. And in return, she made me a display out of Lego that says, "I love you." Our time together was a gift beyond measure that I will cherish and carry with me for the rest of my life. We're recording this episode on December 13th, a little over a month after her death, and it's still really hard to put into words how I feel. It's strange in a way because grief is unifying in that everyone experiences it. And yet, that experience is entirely unique to each individual in each individual situation. Tonight is the seventh night of Hanukkah, and I feel like the menorah. I'm full of light, but I'm missing a candle. So let's talk about grief.
What a strong image, Ethan. Wow.
Yeah, that was very beautifully said. And I am, I don't want to say looking forward to the conversation. But I think where this conversation seems to be headed is places that people don't often talk about or are not often comfortable talking about. And I think the three of us have a good enough relationship where we'll be able to support each other through whatever difficult topics come up. But I will also say that Lego Masters is a great show.
Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoyed it on this end as well.
Yeah, I fully understand what you mean, Barak.
About Lego Masters?
I mean, yes. And the idea of both looking forward while dreading something at the exact same time, that's been the story of the last few weeks of the celebration of life we did in Houston and then the one in Austin, going to support group looking forward to this recording today. Part of me is so excited for this and part of me is terrified. So right now I'm very numb, but I fully understand what you mean. And some of this comes through, and just so much love to Kaya's family, how very directly they are choosing to talk about this and be direct about this, to talk about death and grief and mental illness and suicide. And so it is important, I think. I want to follow their lead. I want to make something happen from this that can be positive and can be constructive in a situation that no one would ever say is positive or constructive. But if we can push the conversation forward for one person, then we have done exactly what it is that we want to do.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with anticipating a powerful conversation with people we care about and about people we care about. And I also want to point out how much I appreciate that you are not using euphemism, and how much more of a powerful conversation it can be if we use words like death and suicide instead of using words that mean the same thing but soften the blow. And when we soften the blow, I think we do ourselves a disservice.
Yeah, we, again, I say we, this is her family. Her obituary very plainly lays it out in those words. She died by suicide, struggled with depression and mental illness her entire life.
It's one of those diseases that people don't have the same kind of sympathy they do for other diseases.
Or understanding.
Of course, which is probably one relates to the other. Mm-hmm. That because people don't always acknowledge it as a disease, you know, people who don't have that illness of depression will say, just get over it. And, you know, that is the perfect solution for someone who's not sick.
Yeah. And this is, you know, stuff I'd said to her. No one would ever say, just get over a broken arm.
Right.
If you were bleeding out of your neck, I wouldn't say, oh, just get over it. You'll just feel better in the morning. Just sleep
it
off.
Tis but a scratch.
It's just a flesh wound. Yeah.
Oh, that's it. Tis but a flesh wound.
But it was a battle for her. And she fought hard and so long. And so that's what's part of what makes this so hard. One of many parts that makes this so hard, I'll say. And I need to pause and get my cat off. Come on.
Yeah, I know.
It's helpful. I think Sylvie is helping make it less heavy and helps us kind of bring our focus back and able to not just totally have all three of us drowning in tissues all night.
I mean, look, Barack, if this part stays in, like...
Anything to have you meowing on microphone, I think, is worth it.
Oh, great. I mean, God bless my cat, her full legal name, Sylvie, the goddess of mischief, who... Cats are so empathic and sensitive to changes in emotion and routine. Like, she's been really not leaving me alone for the last month. It's been really, really nice.
You know, I didn't encounter a lot of mental illness or suicide or depression growing up. And when I got to college, both people that had already existed in my life and new people that had come into my life, there were four or five that I had discovered or found out had severe depression or suicidal attempts in prior to or during my first semester freshman year. And it was a really big jump of understanding. So part of me is happy that we're doing this for our listeners. You know, this is something that should be talked about. And it's, I don't know the percentages. We're not a medical podcast, but that was a lot of people in a few weeks for me to find out were suffering. And I had no idea prior to that. And I think, you know, the fact that Ethan came back and this is the first thing we're talking about is it's good awareness that he could have come on and we could have done a regular Smash episode. And you would have thought, okay, well, they're doing their thing. But on top of everything that's going on in the world right now and in our jobs and in this podcast, you know, Ethan's going through this and we're supporting him however we can. But this is still a part of what's going on behind the scenes. Otherwise, people would not be aware. Everybody loses somebody every day. It's just sort of a stark realization.
Yeah, this has been a life-altering experience for me. There is my life before the 8th and my life from the 8th onward. And I flew home for a couple of days, like just a few days after this all happened. And so I was sitting in the Austin airport and basking in the anonymity that for the first time in days, I was sitting in a crowd of people and no one had any idea who I was. And no one knew what I had gone through, what I was currently going through. And I realized, how many people have I passed in my life who are in the middle of the literal worst day of their life? It's a feeling I'm never going to forget. Like, how many people have I seen, have I talked to, have I interacted with who are literally experiencing the worst day of their life?
It happens to me all the time. As someone who guides people through this kind of experience, and no one's experience is the same, but people who are grieving come to their clergy. And like we've expressed, it is a terrible part of my job and at the same time a wonderful part of my job, because it's an honor to be there for people who I care about. I often find that the Jewish grieving process makes a lot of sense for us as mourners. You mentioned that she died a little over a month ago, and I know it was a little less than a month ago when the funeral was, which means you're still in a period called Shloshim, 30 days after the funeral service. And it's immediately after a period called Shiva, which is seven days after, and 30 days after. Both are time periods where we mark different styles of mourning, where the first 7 days we do pretty much nothing but sit and take care of ourselves and let others take care of our physical needs while we're trying to fix our hearts. And then the first 30 days are this semi-mourning where you're kind of going back to things and it's not exactly right, and you're picking up on all the reasons why it's not the same. And whether you're reveling in the anonymity of people at the airport or you're dealing with people sticking their head in your office every 5 minutes, I'm so sorry, I heard. And then that leads into Shana, which means year, when there's a year of who knows what's going to happen. You alluded to it earlier. Grief is your master. And a date on the calendar, a birthday, a holiday, it will remind you. You look at that Lego structure that says, I love you, or a picture on your phone, and you'll smell something and it'll just trigger memory. Wonderful memory, beautiful memory. And that's why it's so painful.
Yeah. Because this happens frequently when I'm talking to you too. You actually...
God. Is this going to be a Star Trek episode reference?
That's coming later. Don't worry.
Okay.
This leads to one of the questions I had written out, which is there a difference between the word grief and mourn?
Yes. I feel like mourning is active,
mm-hmm.
and grief is done to you.
So if I say I'm grieving or I'm mourning, that's different things.
Well, there's context. When you choose to use it as an I form, then you choose how it's affecting you. But I would say in general, mourning is a process and it's something that we have to engage with, whereas grief is something that happens to us.
Mm.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if I may disagree with RDY here. Both of them to me feel like processes. And I think for me, grieving feels isolated, and mourning to me, I always imagine others surrounding me when I'm mourning at a Shiva, at synagogue.
Your Jewishness.
It's my Jewishness kicking in.
Biasing the definition, yeah.
Yeah, that could be, like, if I'm saying I'm grieving, part of me feels like that would be, you know, me when I was over my mom's funeral plot as the, and like, you know, surrounded by people, but everybody else sort of fades away. And it's me in my head, my heart, just thinking about it. I think for me, they're very similar. And maybe the grieving is for me personal, and mourning is when I'm feeling supported.
Yeah, I could make this like a bad wedding speech and be like, according to dictionary.com, the definition of love is blah, blah, blah.
Wuv. If you're going to do it a bad wedding speech, you should say the definition of wuv.
Wuv. Marriage. Yeah, I've been thinking of mourning as being a little more ritualized, a little more process-based, a little more perhaps intentional. And grief is about like the overall emotional experience, the overall like state of being. I mean, I can't tell you where the time has gone these last 5-6 weeks. I mean, this is, you know, went from the longest day of my life to then the longest week of my life and then the longest month of my life. And like, there are times I'll be sitting at work and I'll just be like, holy crap, it's 3:30. What happened to my day? And I don't know where the time goes. I have moments where I'll laugh and feel like legitimate joy and it feels so good until like, I'm still in the part where like 5-10 seconds later, the wave of, oh yeah, too bad everything else sucks, kind of like comes back over you. But, you know, again, everyone's experience is different. Thankfully, I'm not in a place of I feel guilty when I get to experience joy and happiness. But it's weird. And again, second half of this question was, what does Judaism have to say about grief versus mourning? And I feel like we've done a good job of that. So,
can I ask a question?
Please.
I was going to ask, while we're on this side of the grief and the mourning, not something I ever like get to bring up in conversation, but something I think about often is, and I'll ask the two of you before I share, but what are some things that others have done for you while you were grieving or mourning that you thought were so impactful, you have made it a practice for you to do towards others? And there's three of everybody needs their own thing in their own way. So it's interesting that we might take that personalized and say, that was so meaningful to me. I'm going to make sure I do that for everybody else. So they're very well, maybe different things. So yeah, go ahead.
I want to preface this by saying, if you have done this or you are a friend of mine and did this to me, that this is not a criticism. But I have learned in the last month or so that when you're reaching out to somebody, when you're asking, how are you? That's not really what you're asking or saying. I mean, there's the answer. I could say, fine, okay. I could be truthful and say, really miserable. Thank you for asking. But that's not what people are communicating, or at least it's not the primary intent, which is not to say that they don't legitimately care what the answer is. They're expressing their love and their care and their support. That's what it means when they reach out and say, how are you? And so it's the people who reached out and just said, I'm thinking about you. I'm holding you in my heart. My thoughts are with you. Or one of the clergy here in Austin who just texted me and said, it's a great day outside. I hope you get to take a walk. And somehow had the ability to know through the universe that I was having a really bad day that day. And that was exactly what I needed. And so for me, what I'm taking from this is you can definitely ask someone, how are you? But be direct. Just say, hey, I'm thinking about you. I love you. I'm holding you in my heart.
It's a real skill to be able to not say stupid things to someone who's mourning. And even we professionals sometimes say stupid things to people who are mourning. There is never the perfect script to follow. And saying, how are you, is what people know from their everyday reactions. And like you said, they mean well. I'll say, to answer your question, Brock, if I may, the thing that people did that really impacted me that I try to do in exchange is they showed up. When my father died, I had been a rabbi for 9 months. And when we were sitting in Cincinnati at the funeral, and in the door walk, my friends, Brian and Ian, who lived in Cleveland and Indiana, respectively, that was incredibly meaningful for me. When my friends Rabbi Amy Fader and Rabbi Michael Alper, who are a married couple working in St. Louis, showed up, having made the 7.5-hour drive to Cincinnati, that meant the world to me. And I know that it's because of that, because of how that made me feel, that Brock and I said to each other, I kind of want to look into plane tickets to Austin right now.
Oh.
And we showed up for you in different ways, I believe.
Yeah, you did.
And we do what we can, because I know that you don't want me to see that you're really a Muppet.
Sounds like something a Muppet would say, but we'll continue onwards. Yeah, that was also really something. You know, the Houston celebration we did was a lot more of like her childhood friends and family. The Austin one was her her coworkers, her colleagues, her kind of later in life friends, and people from work who know me but didn't really know her showed up. And when I tell you that, like, it floored me, it really, really did. You know, years ago when my youngest sister was diagnosed with cancer, one of my coworkers, Mindy, who had her own cancer journey, was just nothing but kind and supportive to me, to Ariana, to my entire family. And something I learned from Mindy that I've really been able to internalize is there's no way to pay it back. What you do is you pay it forward. And that's what she was doing for us. And that's what I will do for everyone who has supported me in this process, who showed up physically or mentally or emotionally, electronically. Pay it forward.
I think that, RDY, what you said was one of the things that I was probably going to say of the people who, you know, drive 4 hours unexpectedly and you just can't believe that it happens. But those are the ones that, you know, I would assume that those friends that drove out to you were close friends, not people that were sort of distant in relationship. But
yeah,
there's two things that I'll share. One thing that I've realized is that during the mourning process, your brain is all over the place and you just can't focus and think, organize your thoughts. And I'm a super type C person. And I remember when I've lost people, I think, not that it's the most meaningful, but it really created an impact for me, is when they had ordered meals for us that like lasted a week or just even a couple of days, not having to worry about food, like just a basic piece, because you need to eat and you can't think about what I'm going to order in or get. And so something that Michelle and I will often do, we mostly do it for adults with kids, but we've done it for others, is we'll order a large meal and have it sent to their house, ask for their, you know, dietary restrictions if we don't know them. But
yeah.
And like, you know, if I go to a shiva, I always bring fruit because people often just bring cakes and sandwiches and like you have a lot of carb stuff. And I remember having fruit and being like, thank goodness, this is not like some puff powdered sugar pastry that I've just been eating this entire week. I need to have, or bagels, like I need to have something more nutritious. So that's one, is I try to nourish the body in addition to the soul nourishing that they're getting. The other thing that helped me, and you know what, I've been holding off this story for so many episodes, and I think I'll share it on this one, is when my mom passed away unexpectedly. It was the week after my sister and I had graduated college. That was a rough year. It's still like you had said before that you still think of stuff for people like this week in terms of Hanukkah. My wife and I had a conversation about the things that we missed that my mom would have done for my boys during Hanukkah. Mm. And I'd gone to services regularly and said the mourner's prayer. And about a year after, I was at services and my rabbi at the time gave a sermon, which I'd heard him give before. Rabbis sometimes cycle through things. And when you are at a synagogue, what'd you say?
I don't know what you're talking about.
And I'd heard it before and it just really hit me differently. So I'm going to share the sermon, although it may make its way back into a future Torah Smash episode because I love the story so much. I'll share it just because if you are in mourning or experiencing some tough times, it for some reason really spoke to me. I'll abbreviate it down. Essentially, King Solomon had his court and his servants weren't getting along because they all felt that he was treating one way better than the others. And so King Solomon, as wise as he was, thought that he would fix this problem by giving that one servant an unsolvable problem. And so he called that servant to his throne and he gave him an order. He said, I want you to go out and find me a piece of jewelry that would make the happiest man sad and the saddest man happy. And the servant, excited because he does a lot of good jobs for the king, he said, I'll go out. And this is where you can extend the story however long you want to create an impact. He traveled north for 5 days. He couldn't find anything, traveled south, traveled east, traveled west, traveled to other countries, yada, yada, sent out loads of other people. Throughout these weeks and months, the king was very happy because his other servants saw that the king gave this servant a rough time, giving him this unsolvable challenge. And so he decided to celebrate and was going to have a dinner. And he asked the servant to have this jewelry by that feast to celebrate. The night before the feast comes, the servant is wandering around the Jewish quarter of the kingdom, and he's in disrepairs, and he notices a jewelry shop. He walks in, and he said, "Hey, I need your help. I'm looking for a piece of jewelry that'll make the happiest man sad and the saddest man happy. Do you have anything like that?" And the Jewish merchant says, "Oh, yes, I have something. Come back in the morning and I'll have it ready for you." Comes back in the morning. He hands him a piece of jewelry, and the servant looks at it, and it's got all these weird etchings on it that he can't understand. And he sees in the merchant's eyes that this is what he needs. He just doesn't know it. So the servant takes the ring, goes to the feast where everybody's gathered, and he opens up the doors, and the king sees him, and he's so thrilled because he knows that he has succeeded. His servant looks like he's in despair, that he hasn't found anything. He's been gone for months. Walks up to the king. The servant hands him the ring, and the smile disappears from the king's face. And it's because the ring was inscribed with three letters, Gimel, Zion, and Yud, which stands for Gam Ze Ya'avor. And that translates to "this too shall pass." And the king knew that when you are in moments of happiness, you have to cherish those moments because they won't be around forever. And you have to savor those pieces. And when you're in the hard times, you shouldn't worry because those hard times aren't going to last forever. And I remember when the rabbi gave that sermon, this weight lifted off of my shoulders. And so I often share it many months after somebody has gone through this process, because part of me thinks that it made such an impact because it was so far out from my initial grieving process that I was able to hear it differently. But that was so impactful for me that it's become a real mantra in my life. And again, I'd heard that sermon a couple of times before that, and that time it really stuck with me, so much so that my wife had it inscribed on the inside of my wedding band. And not like, "This is the, my marriage is going to end." That's not what that means. It's more of just remembering.
"You were getting married. This too shall pass."
Yeah. It's more of just a reminder that I need to cherish those good times and not worry so much about the bad times, because get through both of those. So
there is a jeweler in Jerusalem who will tell you that story as he is inscribing the ring.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So I did promise some Star Trek earlier in the episode. In the days that followed, on a good day, on a good week, it's hard for me to answer, what do I need to do to take care of myself? Right after Kaya died, it's like, well, it's anyone's guess. But I made the decision, you know what? I'm going to start rewatching my favorite Star Trek, the best Star Trek, which, as we know, is Deep Space Orville. Nine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What was that, Barack? I didn't hear that.
Orville.
Oh, what was that? I didn't.
Galaxy Quest?
Yes, there we go. Yeah, Galaxy Quest is. Honestly, I don't know how we haven't done an episode on that. Let's table that for a second. What was it? Oh, yeah, the best Star Trek, Deep Space Nine. And, you know, I know that, like, the three captains of, like, 90s era Trek all carry grief and trauma. Picard from, you know, what happened to him in the Borg. Janeway making a decision to fling her crew 80 years travel away, you know, sacrificing essentially her life with her fiance to do what she thought was right. And then there is Benjamin Sisko from Deep Space Nine, who in the very first moments of Deep Space Nine, we see that he loses his wife and has to raise his son as a single father. And
this is what you started watching?
Yeah.
Oh, was that rough?
It was, I mean, I was still at that point very numb. But part of what made it transformative, Barack, and I'm so glad you asked this, is the second half of the episode, and it's a two-parter, is Sisko makes contact with this alien life form that is truly alien. They are truly alien. They're non-corporeal. They have no bodies. They don't experience linear time in the same way that you and I do. And Sisko has to explain his existence to these aliens who have no frame of reference. And so they start bouncing between these moments in his life. And Sisko, another reason why he's the best, loves baseball. And so he's able to eventually use the metaphor of baseball to begin to explain this idea of linear time. He's like, when the pitcher throws the ball, we don't know what the outcome is. Will the batter hit it? Will it miss? Will it be caught? We don't know. For us, that outcome is not yet known. And aliens seem to understand it, but they transport him back to the memory of where he was when his wife died. And they said, you exist here too. And Sisko broke down and eventually says, yeah, part of it is not linear. I'm still here from 3 years ago in this space. And the experience was also healing and liberating for him. And it was part of what made him realize that he wanted to stick with this assignment. You know, Deep Space Nine was like this butts end of the galaxy sort of outpost. And this experience with these aliens gave him some of the healing and closure he needed to move on. And the reality, I think, is that, you know, Barak, this too shall pass. Part of me will never leave that space because Kaya will always be a part of me. Mm-hmm. Just as Sisko's wife was always a part of him. But over the course of 7 seasons of Deep Space Nine, Sisko learns and grows, and he's able to fall in love and actually have a child with this new woman who he loves and cares very deeply for. And so that's definitely skipping ahead from the pilot episode, but there is comfort in knowing that this level of grief will pass. This level of mourning will pass. I can never go back to where I was before November 8th, but that I will establish a new normal. I can't articulate it for you right now, but I accept and understand that that is a thing that will happen. And that I'll establish a new normal. I mean, one of the things that, again, like we talk about the support and love and care from people, but my coworker Iris very eloquently said that moments like this, things like this can consume you or it can transform you. Mm-hmm. And the choice, not the choice, but I have the agency to shape which one of those it is. And I cannot let this consume me. So I'm going to make sure it transforms me. And so when I think about a character from nerddom who has suffered a loss like this and allowed it to transform them, I definitely think of Sisko. And I'm curious if you have characters who maybe you associate with grief who have allowed it to transform them as opposed to consume them.
I have so many things to say about what you just said
before he introduces the smash at the end of the episode.
I know, right? So before I answer your question, I want to comment on something you said in your beautiful comparison to Star Trek. First is that the idea that time is not linear to us, I don't think time is something that we experience. I think time is a measurement, and specifically a measurement of distance. And how we travel through space, and I would say how we travel through our life, is measured in time. And, you know, the idea of stages of grief, the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model of 5 stages of grief, where we go through them not in a linear way. And you have to say them in a certain order because we can't speak more than one word at the same time. And so they're established in a certain order, and maybe they're established in the order that she found most poignant to write about, but that's not the order for everyone. And you can feel 2 things at once or 5 things at once. And I forget the name of the doctor who worked with her, who assisted her on the project, who wrote another book about the 6th stage of grief, which is acceptance. And even if we come to acceptance, we can still experience the other 5 stages whenever. And again, like, it's not linear. Like, there are moments where I just find my eyes drifting over to a picture of my dad and I'll go into melancholy for a moment. And even the idea of Gamzeya Avor, this too shall pass, not permanently. So the other thing I want to say that we acknowledge that we're changed, like you just said. And there's a ritual for that in Judaism. It's called Kriya. It's where we, in today's world, we pin a black ribbon to our clothing and tear it. Kriya means tearing. And it used to be that you would tear a piece of clothing, and we've changed that habit. Although when I was a teenager, I saw people slice their neckties. But in modern times, like since I've been working as a rabbi, I've never seen someone tear an actual piece of clothing. But you tear the cloth, and you're not allowed to tear it on a seam. Because if you tear it on a seam and sew it back up again, it looks the same. You have to tear it on a whole cloth. Because if you tear it on whole cloth and sew it back up again, it looks scarred. Just like we are scarred. Just like we are permanently changed. And it is also said when we wear it on the outside of our clothing, it's said to be a reflection of the tear on our hearts.
I never knew that about the, it has to be on, I understand why they're not the same, but it sounds like the Japanese practice of kintsugi, I think it's called, the gold.
A little different, except that kintsugi is made beautiful and kriya is made scarred.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I guess it's making me interpret it as, if I'm thinking about it, as that person's life has changed me, right? That knowing them changed me for the better, and that this shift is a reminder that I'm made better for knowing that person. And that would be my gold lining there. Before you get to your character of grief, RDY, I will add on, I really liked that non-linear alien story with Cisco, because while that sermon had helped me, Gamzeya Avor, there are still moments where if I really want to have a very strong feeling or memory about my mom, I just need to put on the song that my synagogue growing up would sing at the end of every Friday night service, and that my mom, the overbearing, wanting to give me too much love that she was, would always just like wrap me in her arm as everybody swayed side to side. And if I put that song on and listen to it and sing to it, I can feel her and I can sense her. And so as much as that this too shall pass, it was really helpful to me. That idea of non-linearity, and you can still be there in that moment so many years later. Totally agree with that. I think that question of what characters are shaped by grief is way too numerous for me to have to isolate, because so many good characters, right? Even if we just looked at the MCU, I think almost every main character has some sort of loss that forces them to make a decision in one way or the other.
I think that's why I was having such trouble answering the question, but I have to go with Batman. So I went out of the MCU, and the death of Batman's parents shaped who he was and transformed him, just like you said, Ethan. And that was a choice that he made. And you know, there are all kinds of problems with Batman. He suffers probably a very similar psychosis to the Joker, and that's why it's such a compelling comic book. But his entire life is shaped by grief. Even in the movie that you and I saw together, Barack, where he, I think we're far enough away from the Flash movie that we're allowed to give spoilers.
We're far enough away from that movie. Yeah.
Like you said, it was a very entertaining bad movie.
Yeah.
The Batman in that movie, well, the Batman in most of the movie, who was played by Michael Keaton, was overwhelmed with his grief. He had gone back into being totally alone with nothing but his grief.
Yeah, I think there's so many to pick from, and I agree that I have not problems with Batman. He's a wonderful character, very entertaining to read, but he makes a dark choice essentially to do good things. I think on the other side of it, I would choose Spider-Man, who was heading in a different direction, and only because of the death of Uncle Ben, or in the MCU, Aunt May. That is what helps him to really focus his energy to the positive, instead of Batman's focus towards fear and reform. So,
yeah. Any closing thoughts?
The club that we're all in of people who have suffered the death of someone we love is a club that everyone will be in and that nobody wants to be in. And when people are going through these difficult times, I know how important it is to just be there for them. And sometimes if we are not the ones mourning, we don't know what to do. If we've never experienced death and we're that lucky that we're a good enough person to go visit, even though we haven't felt that comfort before, it's okay to not say anything. It's okay to just sit there. And sure, it might feel awkward, but it might be just what they need. And to both of you, I so appreciate you and the comfort and strength that you give me in dealing with little things. And Ethan, I can't wait to put my arms around you in person next month and just really give you a big squeeze and say I love you face to face.
Ethan, you have to tell me what it's like to be hugged by a Muppet.
Oh, Barack, you beat me to my own punchline.
I'll add a little ending thing for me. On that note of Batman and Spider-Man taking their grief in those ways, I think that's something that we can take away from those stories as well when we face grief of loved ones is, you know, I don't know if Batman's parents would be happy of the course that he took with what he did. I think they'd be proud that he was bettering the city, but I don't know if they'd agree with his methods. I think Uncle Ben would be very proud of Spider-Man in almost every way. And so when we lose somebody and it affects us and changes us as it will, try to remember what is it that that person would want me to become from this. Every person we lose, I can't think of anybody who would want somebody to just turn inward and isolate, or to turn that all into anger and act out towards others in negative ways. I think that those people that we love want us to continue on and use the time we had with them as inspiration to give back to the world, to give back to others, to share that love forward. And I do hope that I've made the people that I've lost proud with the decisions that I've made and how those experiences have changed me. So I hope that everybody, whatever part of grief or mourning that you are in, you can reflect back and share the love that they shared with you towards others.
In all of my stress and anxiety about this episode, I realize now I didn't write myself a conclusion. And I think that's poetic, because I think that's what grief is like. I think that's what suffering and enduring a loss like this is kind of like. It's not really a conclusion. It will change over time. It will evolve over time. You know, like Cisco, I have hope for my ability to become a better person, to fall in love again, but it's going to take time. This will always be a part of me for the entire rest of my life. And sometimes time isn't linear, you know? There may not be a conclusion to this, but that's how it goes here on planet Earth, or if you're one of the wormhole aliens from Deep Space Nine.
By there being no conclusion, that's how her memory lives with you forever. Hamakom yinachem otcha betoch she'ar v'alit Zion v'Yerushalayim. May God comfort you among all those who mourn in Zion and Jerusalem. May Kaya's memory be a blessing.
In how I think about her, in how I choose to treat others, in terms of those moments that I can feel the magic she was able to catch and create every day in her classroom. You know, I'm one of those people who really does believe that like working with kids and young people is really a way to like plant a seed that will travel so far into the future. And if I can do that in a way that captures the magic she could, then I mean, she's already going to live forever because of the kids she worked with as the most incredible teacher. But if others around her, myself, her coworkers, her co-teacher, Sarah, everyone, if we do that for just one person, then her legacy will stretch on forever. And that's how we end this episode.
Amen.
I want to thank both of you for giving me the space and the opportunity to do this. When I presented the idea of like, what do we do for my first episode back? there was no hesitation from either of you of like, yeah, let's just do it. Like, let's go right for it. And you already had so much thanks and appreciation from me for the love and support you've shown me over the last few weeks. And this just furthers it. So just, I love you guys.
Love you too. Yeah,
love you too.
Today's episode touched on some challenging topics, but there are resources available. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, has a helpline, support groups, and resources. You can call or text 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline for free and confidential crisis and suicide prevention counseling 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you or someone you know recently lost a loved one and is in need of support, we urge you to contact and connect with your local clergy or an appropriate local or national grief counseling service. You don't have to go through this alone.
If you are not connected to a clergy person, no matter what your religion, please call me. I can be reached at any time at 833-722-2701 or by email at rabbidny@gmail.com.
For all those we've lost, we say, Zikronam Livracha. May their memories be for a blessing.